happens when millions of people are forced to leave their own homes because of conflict, violence, development risk, disasters, and climate change. Do these millions of people have rights? Have you ever thought that maybe internal displacement is the greatest tragedy of our times, and that people being displaced are among the most vulnerable of the human family? Welcome, everyone. I'm Gina Murphy Darling, and that's what we are going to be talking about for this next hour. Thanks so much for listening and for being a part of our world. A big shout out and thanks to the sponsor of this show, the Chapman Automotive Group. As a company, they are committed to doing their share and showing they care about their employees, their community, and the planet. Their Community Green Team is actively involved in year-long activities that impact both the internal operations of the company as well as the community through their hands-on philanthropy. Thank you, Chapman, for being disruptors for good, for doing the right thing. For more information about Chapman, please visit chapmantucson.com, and I hope you'll check them out. This is the third of our five-part series for the month of May, spotlighting women leading the charge to address global warming. We believe there is no better moment in history to accelerate the cause of gender equality around the world than by raising the voices of brilliant women who are creating positive change by doing the good thing, the right thing, for all who call our planet home. Joining us for this next hour is Alexandra Bilak. She is the director of Internal Displacement Monitoring Center in Geneva, Switzerland. IDMC is the leading source of information and analysis on internal displacement. Their data and evidence serves to keep the issue and the plight of these internally displaced people high on the global agenda. Welcome, Alexandra, and thanks so much for taking the time to be with us today to share your information on the important work you're doing, and as I said, perhaps more important now than ever before. So much conflict around the globe, and the timing of the show for me could not be better. So I'm going to ask you to do a lot of talking, and I will do very little, I hope, just asking some questions. But you were established in 1998 at the request of the international community. What kind of gaps were there, and what were you seeking to fill?
Okay, well, thank you very much, Gina, and thanks for having me on your show. It's really a great honor to be talking to you today. So indeed, we're celebrating 20 years of global monitoring of internal displacement, and we were set up in 1998 at a time when the issue of internal displacement was only just emerging on the international agenda. You'll recall in the early 1990s, we were looking at some of the world's worst conflicts across Iraq. There was the Rwandan genocide, Bosnia, and a number of people were becoming internally displaced, meaning they were displaced inside their own countries. And the international community, through the what we call the Interagency Standing Committee here in Geneva, but also in New York, came together to call for the establishment of an information center to better analyze, first of all, to better quantify the scale of this phenomenon. It was still relatively unknown how massive this phenomenon was worldwide, how many people were becoming affected every year, how many people were living in displacement, where they were, and how severe their displacement was. So the international community called for the setting up of some kind of information data, you know, a database, an information hub on this issue. And this is how IDMC was set up. We were set up in 1998 first as the Global IDP Project, and a few years later we became IDMC, the Internal Displacement Monitoring Center. And we were at the time hosted, it was the Norwegian Refugee Council, a Norwegian international now humanitarian agency that stepped forward and said, we will host this thing, this information hub, and this is how we were born and how we came about.
So tell us in detail, and I really want you to take as much time as you care to, about what it is you do and why you do it. It really is incredibly important work. And while I was listening to your response, the 20-year time frame, it's incredible to me what it was like then and how things have accelerated since then. It's not exactly a lot of progress from where I sit. So share with us And I can't say it enough, it's such important work. So what is it you do and why do you do it?
Okay, so what we do and the reason why we were originally set up is that we monitor basically the entire world to detect new instances of internal displacement, but also to monitor over time situations of internal displacement, so internal displacement caseloads and how they evolve over time. So let me explain a little bit what that means. We are a team of 23 people here in Geneva, so we're relatively small. So we don't collect any data ourselves because we just don't have the capacity to do that. it would be impossible. So what we do is we analyze and interpret data that is collected by a huge variety of sources on the ground. So we started in 1998 looking only at conflict-related internal displacement. So at the time, in 1998, we were monitoring about 23 conflict-affected countries, and we were relying mostly on the data that was provided by some of the humanitarian agencies operating on the ground. In some cases, we were having to rely on government data, although in a conflict context, that is not the primary source of data, the most reliable source of data that we want to use. So we were monitoring 23 countries at the time. Now, over time, of course, the number of countries affected by conflicts increased, but also our capacity to digest data also increased. So over time, the number of countries that we monitored for conflict really increased. We're now monitoring 55 countries in the world affected by conflict, and we're monitoring those on a regular basis for conflict-related internal displacement.
It doubled.
Yeah, exactly. And that's due to a combination of factors, of course, an increasing of the phenomenon itself of conflict displacement, but also to an increase of the coverage of data providers on the ground. So from 23 to 55 conflict-affected countries. Now, in 2008, 10 years after we were set up, we realized that we were missing a huge part of the global picture. And this is when we started actually looking at disaster-related displacement. We realized, of course, a number of our partners were beginning to have to respond operationally on the ground to disaster, to natural hazard-related disasters across the world and the impact that they were having, in some cases leading to massive humanitarian crises. But we also noticed that the policy environment within which we were operating was also changing. So rather than only looking at sort of conflict-ridden, fragile states and having a purely sort of humanitarian conversation about the issue, we also started looking at other forms of at other sort of emerging global challenges like climate change, disaster risk reduction, urbanization and urban resilience, etc. And so it widened also our scope of policy interlocutors and policy work. So in 2008, by including and incorporating the issue of disaster-related displacement in our work, we significantly expanded not just the analytical scope of our work, but also the geographical scope. Because as I can explain to you a little bit later, disaster-related displacement is actually an issue that touches not just low and lower middle-income countries, but that can also affect high-income countries like the U.S., like Japan, etc. So we're now actually having to monitor the entire world because theoretically every country in the world is at risk of disaster-related displacement, either now or in the future. So we are now. My team here of about 10 monitoring experts and analysts working with us are monitoring. They each monitor a portfolio of countries, but they are covering the entire globe. And the way they do that, as I said, is not by collecting the data themselves, but by making sense of any form of data that they may find at the very local level all the way up to the national and the regional level. So we rely on a huge range of data sources in the humanitarian context that we follow, where there is a strong presence of humanitarian agencies, like, for example, in many sub-Saharan African countries and the Middle East. We're looking at data that is provided by some of the key UN agencies working on displacement and migration issues, like IOM and UNHCR, but also OCHA, the Office for the Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs. So this data is collected mostly for humanitarian programming purposes, but now more and more, some of these UN agencies are also collecting data simply to monitor the flows, displacement and migratory flows across countries and regions. So we use a lot of that data for our own estimates. Now, when there are no humanitarian actors on the ground, which is the case unfortunately in many, many countries, we have to rely on other sources of data. So when it comes to disaster displacement, in some countries, national governments have actually relatively good and robust disaster loss databases that also track displacement figures. It's the case in the Philippines, in Indonesia, where we actually use government data to come up with our estimates. In other countries, that's not the case. So we have to then make do with the data that we find, either through local NGOs, through media reports, or simply through our network of partners on the ground. But the more incomplete the data, the more explicit we have to be in publishing our estimates, and we are very, very transparent in the limitations of this data. We try and always caveat the figures that we report on by indicating whether they're an underestimate or an overestimate based on the information that we have and on the way in which we've triangulated it from different sources.
So fascinating stories, many stories within stories in that. And I would just like to explain that the UNHCR, for people that not by aware, is the United Nations for High Commissioner for Refugees. Are there cases when the government doesn't want to participate? And I would think about if it's basically a political conflict, do you get reliable data from government if it's available, or are there times when they really don't want to be cooperative because they don't want this international community to be aware of what's going on?
No, absolutely. I mean, that's quite a common scenario that we come across. I can cite a few countries where we have had to be very careful in how we publish our estimates. We've had to explain very clearly and with a lot of backup information how we came up with our figures, particularly when our estimates are in almost complete contradiction with statistics that are provided by national governments. Of course, the issue of internal displacement is so political. It's such a sensitive topic for many governments, because ultimately what we are counting and what we're analyzing is really a phenomenon that says something about, that really is a symptom of state failure in many ways. You're looking at countries that often don't have the capacity to cope with the impact of internal displacement. But in some contexts, as you say, we're looking at conflict dynamics where the state itself has been involved in creating the internal displacement in the first place. So in some contexts, you'll have governments who don't want us to report on this phenomenon, who deny even that internal displacement exists and is taking place on their territory. And then in other contexts, you may have governments who are trying to overinflate figures because they're trying to access, humanitarian funding or other sources of funding. So you're really looking at different types of political games that are being played around this issue, and that make it all the more important for our analysis and our information to be as transparent, as rigorous, and as objective as possible. But it does mean that in certain contexts, we, as much as we try to have open with some of these governments, in some cases, we are looking at a total breakdown of communication where we just cannot see eye to eye. And then we just have to sort of agree to disagree. It's been the case, you know, if you take a country like Syria, where the civil war has completely disrupted, you know, the provision of public services across the country, but where you're looking at a very fragmented territory right now, it's been virtually impossible to come up with nationally aggregated figures that will, you know, that can be endorsed by all the parties to the conflict. In actual fact, over the last few months of 2017, we've seen a total shutdown of data collection activities in the country, which has made it very difficult to come up with an accurate, updated figure, latest figure of the total number of IDPs right now in Syria. But that's also the case in other countries like the DRC, the Democratic Republic of Congo, where some of the data that we have, you know, is rarely geographically comprehensive, you know, so you'll get pockets of data coverage that are relatively good and reliable, and other areas in the country, the example being recently the eruption of violence in the Kasai region of the country, where there were absolutely no humanitarian providers on the ground, and for a long time we had no access to any form of data. So that makes for a very incomplete picture at the local, at the national level, and then ultimately at the global level. And it's that incomplete picture that we're trying to work on gradually over time, and we're gradually trying to fill those gaps. But it's a painstaking process sometimes.
Yeah. And I just like to explain a little bit again about some of the words that I use and the terms that come out, that I've done a lot of research, but our listeners may not be as familiar with it. When you talk about internal displacement, is that for human beings, people, men, women, and children, that are being displaced within their own country and having to move out of where they live to another place within the country? Or is it both, you know, inside and then people that are forced to leave their country?
So internal displacement, as you say, refers to a forced movement of persons, individuals, inside their own country. So an IDP, an internally displaced person, has not crossed an internationally recognized border. So they're not a refugee, they're not an international migrant, they're not an asylum seeker, they are internally displaced. So they remain under the jurisdiction of their national government.
And it's such...
And in that sense, they... Sorry.
No, it's
sorry
okay, to, but it's... In, go ahead.
No, in that sense, they don't benefit from an international protection regime in the same way that refugees do. They are ultimately under the responsibility of their governments, and that's why the issue of internal displacement is particularly difficult and problematic from a political perspective when you are looking at countries that either are in full-blown conflict, where there is no political will to address this issue, or countries that are typically fragile and don't have the capacity to cope and to protect and assist their own displaced citizens on their own territory.
And you answered my question. It's such an important nuance in terms of understanding the scope of this, because if you're a refugee, all kinds of things come into place for your ability to migrate to other countries. Numbers are reported differently, but it's so important for me that people, that we understand it's what's going on within countries themselves and people that basically have no homes because their homes have been destroyed. So we are going to take a very short break, and I have so many more questions when I come back, and I would love to talk about some of the uses for the data and why it's so important mm-hmm. from a global perspective, what it matters. And then okay. I'd like to go into a little detail about some of the places that are hotspots, and not just Syria, which does make the news, but sub-Saharan Africa and South America and Asia. So everybody, please stay here with us. We're having an incredible conversation with Alexandra Bilak, who is the director of the, my brain is going faster than my mouth. That's what happens.
The Internal Displacement Monitoring,
the IDCM, which is a leading source of information and analysis on internal displacement and playing such an important role in what's going on in our world. We'll be right back. 30-second break.
join us for a new on-demand podcast every week at MrsGreensWorld.com. You can also find us on iTunes, iHeartRadio, Stitcher, and Speak Up Radio. Connect with us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. Stay in touch with information about healthy living, sustainability, contests, and events by signing up for our newsletter on our website. If you have questions or comments about this podcast or others, please write to us at info@MrsGreensWorld.com. We'd love to hear from you. But now, back to our story.
And welcome back, everyone. I am Gina Murphy-Darling, and this is Mrs. Green's World. Thanks for joining us. Global warming and people displacement. What's next? Who's next? Joining us to answer some of these questions is Alexandra Bilak, Director of the Internal Displacement Monitoring Center in Geneva. It is the leading source of information and analysis on internal displacement. Their data and evidence serve to keep the issue and the plight of internally displaced people high on the global agenda. Alexandra, once again, thanks so much for spending time with us.
Thank you.
You provide global monitoring, policy, and influencing, and research and analysis on internally displaced people. And all of your data, which impressed me, is available online. When you talk about open and, you know, full transparency, it's mind-blowing. So again, thanks for being here. But let's go back to what do you do with the data? You collect massive amounts of data. What are some of the important uses for it?
Yeah, so I mean, as you said, you know, the primary importance of our data is to keep the issue of internal displacement on the agenda, on the political agenda. This is an issue that is, because it's happening behind national borders, it tends to be far more invisible than refugee or migrant flows worldwide. So our data is used very much to just report on this phenomenon on a regular basis. We try to publish our estimates not just once a year, but on a much more regular and frequent basis. Hence the open sourced nature of our data on our website. So the primary objective is to keep this issue on the agenda, and to basically be that temperature gauge on the state of the world, because we do acknowledge and we very much believe that internal displacement is the symptom of how a national government is faring, how a country is faring, whether it's on sustainable development, poverty reduction, climate change adaptation, you know, stability, security, economic health, etc. So a country that is suffering from high levels of internal displacement needs to be needs attention, and it needs attention at the international level. So we use the data first and foremost to keep the issue on the agenda. We also use our analysis is also used to put new and emerging issues on policymakers' radar screens. So it's been the case over the years, as we have clearly demonstrated, for example, displacement as one of the major impacts of climate change. And this has, I think, been instrumental in shifting the discourse on climate change globally. And I would say that it's thanks not just to IDMC's work, but to our work in combination with our partners. And ultimately, it is about shaping the way in which policy and financial investments globally are made. Our objective by publishing this data and by publishing this research and this analysis is to help redirect political attention and financial resources to where they're the most needed. The fact that we are reporting year in, year out, double the number of IDPs in the world as there are refugees, is often a sort of reality check to policymakers at the global level to say, you know, there are far more people right now who are internally displaced inside their countries than there are, you know, refugees or migrants. So when we see, you know, panic levels rising when refugees arrive in Europe, for example, we would like policymakers to be reminded that there are actually far more people displaced inside their countries, and for not for policy or not for political attention to shift away from refugees, but certainly for internal displacement to be considered an integral part of the full global displacement and migration picture.
And when you think about it in terms of just an analogy, in the mental health profession is in the United States and globally, there's prevention and there's treatment. And what we do is treatment. We don't do prevention. If they're looking internally at those people, helping them and providing resources and jobs and the ability to relocate in some sustainable way would really help stem the flow of outward migration. It's like get to the root of where the challenges are and start providing aid to prevent the next wave.
Exactly. And in fact, that was precisely the message that we communicated last year. Our global report last year was focused on the relationship between internal displacement and cross-border movements. And what we were trying to demonstrate was that internal displacement that remains unresolved for long periods of time will have, you know, knock-on effects and spillover effects, either in the form of cross-border refugee flows or wider sort of migratory movements. And ignoring that, ignoring the starting point of these displacement trajectories is a very short-sighted approach.
As usual, it's like a little bit of my bias has to leak out there, just a little bit. And are there cases, once I really understand the magnitude and scope to some extent of what you do, but are you able to actually collect data on people that are able to return to their homes? And how are you able to track that? Or is that not under your purview?
No, it is absolutely part of our mandate. We try to monitor how displacement situations evolve over time. So particularly in countries where we're looking at long-term conflict, like in the DRC, South Sudan, Nigeria, Somalia, but also in the Middle East and in many countries even across the world, in Asia and Central America, where we're looking at conflicts that have gone on for several years and where we know that there are people who have been displaced for, in some cases, up to decades. We're trying to track how their displacement situation evolves over time. So in some cases, we know that the severity of their displacement gets worse over time. So you can imagine, for example, the situation of a Syrian IDP over the course of 6-7 years of civil war. They're not getting closer to what we call a durable solution to their displacement. So whereas in other countries, for example, in Colombia, where we're looking at a massive caseload of IDPs, but a country that is at the same time making progress towards peace and more stability, we can expect the total number of IDPs to gradually decrease, we hope, over the next few years. So part of our monitoring of these situations over time, of course, also includes monitoring of potential return movements, because we consider a displacement to have ended when a person has sustainably returned back to their home, to their area of origin, and has sort of recovered back to the same sort of an adequate standard of living, let's say, to what they knew pre-displacement. So we try to track returns across the world. Unfortunately, and this is where the data gaps come into play, there is actually insufficient tracking and monitoring of these return movements, particularly in those protracted contexts where typically humanitarian agencies may have left the countries and no one is monitoring these situations anymore. In fact, what we'll be publishing in our next report will be showing that for those countries where we were able to access data on returns, we weren't able to really make a sound, to actually come up with a sound judgment on whether or not those returns were sustainable. Because in many cases, as you can imagine, if you're looking at IDP returns in countries that are still experiencing ongoing conflict, whether it's in, you know, Afghanistan, Syria, Iraq, Nigeria, DRC, there are return movements. People are returning home, but they are returning back to conditions of insecurity and conflict and open violence that make us doubt how sustainable and how sustainable these returns will be. So even if we are able to count and to quantify these return movements, they still don't always allow us to actually start taking people off the books, if you will.
And how much of the returning to home, quote unquote, is possible? In Syria is a perfect example where there has been so much explosive contamination, not just their homes destroyed, but going back to places that are literally unsafe for human habitation. What then?
Well, exactly. I mean, that's the question that we would like to put also to, obviously, the Syrian government, the international community that right now is supporting, returns of not just IDP returns, but Syrian refugee returns right now to a country where the conditions in many places are not conducive to a sustainable reintegration back in these areas of origin, where, as you say, you're looking at either destroyed homes, no public services available. So, why would people want to return back to those conditions? And of course, in some cases, people are returning because they do want to go back home and they want to start rebuilding. But I think it's clear that in some contexts, and many contexts, not just Syria, across the world, those returns are both premature, but also may also lead ultimately to more displacement.
So there's a question here, just trust me that there's a question here because it's a little bit of a long explanation, but I would think that historically, since the agency started, most of the IDPs are due to political conflicts and war. Another piece of it that I think is significant is now there are really climate refugees because of water, drought, starvation. Do you have a sense in your view of having your finger in a lot of these places? Is it shifting? Are you seeing more political conflict or the same? Or are you seeing an increase in the number of refugees because of climate change? Not refugees, displaced persons, sorry.
I mean, actually, if you look at our figures over the last 10 years or so, you would see actually that, I'll simplify, but I think it's accurate to say that every year we report more people displaced by climate-related hazards and disasters than we do by conflict. Now, there are all sorts of reasons behind that. So we report huge numbers of people displaced, particularly across Asia, by natural hazard-related disasters, up to, last year, I can't remember now what the figures were, but we were, I think, close to 22 million people displaced during the year by disasters, which was far more than the people displaced by conflict. Now, our numbers, our figures for disaster-related displacement and climate, mostly climate-related displacement, also that they include people who are evacuated to avoid the impact of disasters. So In some cases, we're looking at displacement as a positive measure. You know, I mean, people have were moved out of their homes as a way to avoid death and destruction as the hurricane hit, for example. But nevertheless, the number of people displaced on an annual basis is higher for climate disasters than it is for conflict. Now, the number itself isn't enough to understand the full picture. We also need to look at the duration of displacement and the severity of the displacement. And of course, in a conflict context, you know, you can't compare an IDP in Syria with, someone displaced by Hurricane Harvey in Texas. But nevertheless, we're looking at two forms of displacement that have their own impacts on human beings and on local communities in their own ways. But certainly, because we're reporting such high numbers of climate-related displacement already now, we can only expect those numbers to increase in the future with the impacts of climate change. And this is why we're calling for displacement to be recognized really as an integral part of the full, you know, sort of climate change picture. And as you say, there's a whole other a massive group of people that we're not even reporting on, that we don't even have numbers for, and those are those people who are becoming displaced by much more, by much longer term almost insidious kind of processes, like slow onset disasters like droughts and sea level rise and desertification, where actually tracking people displaced by those phenomena is virtually impossible because no one is monitoring it and the data is simply not available. Also because we're looking at much more complex phenomena. If you look at drought across sub-Saharan Africa, it's so closely interlinked also with political factors and conflict dynamics, that disentangling the environmental dimension from the political dimension is very difficult. So right now we're not reporting global numbers for drought-related displacement, but it's clear given the number of the hundreds of millions of people affected by drought in the world, that huge numbers of people are also gradually having to leave their homes as a result of that.
And to your point, it's the most devastating, and in many cases, it will be permanent. And of all of the impacts, if there's internal conflict because of a war, and there's an effort for peace, there's a possibility of returning and not ever having life go on as usual, but some semblance of returning to your town or your city. But if you are, when you talk about Africa and the areas that are disappearing literally underwater, these are permanent. These are not, you know, they can't just move to another area of town that wasn't destroyed. It's so pervasive and so impactful and so permanent from where I sit.
Exactly. And exactly.
I think about the United States, and I don't want to in any way minimize the tragedies of the hurricanes that we have had and the devastation and some people's lives being ruined forever. But let's be honest. In the United States, it still is a land of opportunity. In spite of what's going on here, you can get another job, you can change a career, you can move to be with a relative. But when I read about the countries, and Africa is a perfect example, sub-Saharan Africa, where are they going to go? I mean, there's no end to that question in terms of human life. What is the future for those people? And it's, of course, my magnificent obsession about helping to stem the tide of climate change as quickly as we can.
No, absolutely. It's true that if you look at some of the regions of the world, like the Pacific or the Caribbean, where you're looking at small island states that are at risk, as you say, of disappearing and therefore permanent displacement. I mean, the distinction there between internal and cross-border displacement no longer applies. I mean, they will have, their homes will disappear and they will have to, of course, move to other countries. And unfortunately, that's not yet something that's really being addressed, at least not sufficiently at the international level. But just a little note on the US, because it's true that, as I said before, it's hard to compare someone displaced by a hurricane in southern United States with someone displaced by conflict and war in Syria or DRC. But nevertheless, what we do see, even in high-income countries like the United States, it's those people who will remain displaced for longer periods of time and for whom recovery will be harder are typically those people who were vulnerable before they became displaced.
Right.
So it's going to be those socioeconomic, those people from lower income groups that will be disproportionately affected compared to, of course, someone who has insurance on their house and who can move in with relatives and who can, rebuild their home relatively quickly. So, I mean, even in high-income countries, we do see levels of vulnerability that are obvious, and it's those people who become disproportionately affected.
And to your point, not being talked about enough, it's the marginalized community for everything in our country.
Exactly.
Where they are hit hardest, hit first, and the recovery takes longer. Even when it comes to the installation of pipelines or gas lines, it's, let's put it where the poor people live, the people that don't have as much of a voice, and obviously that's
exactly
not something that makes me happy when I get up in the morning. So we're ready to come on our second very fast break, and we come back. I would like to talk to you a little bit about the paper you wrote, Time to Reframe Policy and Practice, and quite a few more questions. Everybody stay here with us. We'll be back in 30 seconds.
It's Meredith, a proud member of the Mrs. Green's World team. We are disruptors for good, passionate game changers working to create a more sustainable, safer, healthier, and socially just planet for all. By creating podcasts like this one, we offer tangible solutions that inspire you to take action. We need your financial support to continue producing content, podcasts, film, and written works that engage, educate, and inspire our global community to fight climate change. Join us today. Visit MrsGreensWorld.com and click Join the Movement.
Welcome back, everybody, and thanks for listening. I'm Gina Murphy-Darling, and this is Mrs. Green's World, and we do thank you for being a part of it and for joining us for this third in a series of podcasts spotlighting women leading the charge to address global warming and other important and significant issues. We really do believe there is no better moment to accelerate the cause of gender equality around the world than by raising the voices of brilliant women who are creating positive change by doing the good thing, the right thing for all of us. And our guest today is one of those brilliant women. Joining us is Alexandra Bilak, director of the Internal Displacement Monitoring Center, which is the leading source of information and analysis on internal displacement. Their data and evidence serve to keep the issue and the plight of internally displaced people high on the global agenda. Alexandra, thank you so much for being with us. I am learning so much. And of course, it's just so near and dear to my heart and so important. And we are one voice that continues to address these issues.
Thank you for having me on your show.
So before we go into your paper or your blog article about reframing practice and policy, I want to go back for a second about when you talk about countries in, you know, like Africa, not the continent and the countries in Africa, does the research and analysis that you do, is it applied to come up with solutions? Is that a part of the mandate? Because it's so massive what you're doing and making available to the international community. What is the application for the research and analysis that you do? Can you give us some examples of why it's so critically important?
Yes, of course. I mean, IDMC doesn't just produce global estimates and statistics on people internally displaced. We also play, I mean, we are the global reference when it comes to internal displacement analysis, but also policy expertise. So we also provide policy advice and support to certain political processes at the country level and at the global level. To give you maybe a few examples, particularly when it comes to sub-Saharan Africa, I think it's fair to say that IDMC was one of the key players actually in the development of what is now recognized as a landmark normative framework for the continent. Africa actually developed what is now called the Kampala Convention. It's a legal framework that a number of countries now in Africa have ratified or are now in the process of implementing. And by ratifying the Kampala Convention on internal displacement, they have committed to developing national level policies and laws to better protect and assist IDPs in their countries. The Kampala Convention will be celebrating its 10th anniversary next year, and at the time when it was being developed, IDMC was actually instrumental and was one of the key players in advising the development of that document and that framework. And then, when the Kampala Convention was actually developed, we've been involved in supporting certain countries in developing a national level IDP policy, or in integrating some of the provisions from the Kampala Convention into their national level legislation. It's now a process that we're continuing, perhaps less from a legal and less of a normative perspective, but more from a broader policy perspective. And perhaps this is a good segue into the article that you wanted to discuss, because what we now see as a priority moving forward at the policy level is for national governments who are affected by the issue of internal displacement to take more of a leading role in finding their own solutions. And we need to recognize that every country is going to deal with it in its own way. So it's not necessarily the case that every single country, for example, in sub-Saharan Africa needs to have its own IDP policy, but it needs to find its own way of incorporating the issue of internal displacement in ongoing national policies and plans. So in some countries, for example, some sub-Saharan African countries may want to address it as part of their commitments under the Sustainable Development Goals, as part of their broader poverty reduction strategy. In other countries, they may want to address it as part of their climate change adaptation plans, their disaster risk reduction plans, depending on what they see as the key policy priority moving forward, but also what they see as politically the most palatable way, let's say, of moving this issue forward without causing obstruction or sort of political sensitivities, to avoid the political sensitivities that may come along the way. So IDMC plays a role in supporting behind the scenes some of these governments in figuring this roadmap out, basically, and in helping them find a solution that is anchored in their own local and national realities, but also drawing from some successful cases and stories that can be learnt from other countries, because this is where our global perspective comes in as very useful. We can actually advise certain governments on the basis of what has worked in other countries. So I think that's a practical also way of looking at IDMC's mandate and how we work.
And in the article, you talked about a recent decision by the United Nations that declared the end of a three-level emergency in the Congo, in the Democratic Republic of the Congo. Mm. When that happens, is it then a ripple effect of aid that's available, of focus from the international community? What is the impact when something like that happens and a declaration like that is made?
Well, originally, when the L3 emergency was declared in the DRC, we welcomed that very much. I mean, like all other humanitarian agencies on the ground who'd been calling for more political attention to the DRC, I mean, the DRC has been relatively, you know, not ignored, but it has been off the radar screen internationally for the last few years. So when the L3 emergency was declared, it was welcomed because it was seen as a positive step towards more humanitarian funding, predominantly humanitarian funding, and then ultimately also some more development, you know, longer term development investments in the country. But ultimately, it was declared to increase humanitarian operations and humanitarian funding for the country, which is why when it was then deactivated only a few months later, there was a bit of an outcry on the part of international humanitarian agencies, because there was a fear, and it's ultimately what will probably end up happening. There was concern that this would preclude, you know, donor governments from coming in and increasing their funding to DRC, which clearly needs it. So that was the starting point of the article, was to sort of use the DRC example as an illustration, as we were saying before, of the very short-term approach that we tend to have for some of these crises, rather than looking at the longer-term implications of the, you know, of the decisions that we're making today.
And I go back to my comment about, for some of these disasters, it's hard to come up with what are the possible solutions. And I refer it again to Africa because it's a place that's near and dear to my heart in terms of watching what's going on and so grossly underreported in the United States. Mm. You know, we have such a very narrow sieve at this point of what we're getting in the networks and the news, and it being, you know, much more controlled and not as much of a free press situation that people, I think, would like to believe we have. It's all being filtered. So to me, some of these solutions, when an entire country or part of an entire continent is suffering from extreme drought, how can we as an international community respond to that? And selfishly, it has an impact on our lives. We may not be thinking it, feeling it, or seeing it, but it's impacting our lives as we speak. The filthy, disgusting fashion industry and what happens and how many refugees are working in subhuman conditions to make clothing for the United States so you can throw it away after three uses. So there's the second Mrs. Green rant, but what I try to get across to people is, yes, it is impacting your life financially and, you know, economically, and we are a global community. So it's this information helps me. I love to dispel myths. And I came across another amazing article on your website, which you may or may not be able to address. I don't expect you to be the expert on all of it, but I encourage people to go to internal-displacement.org and spend some time there if you want a global perspective. But what about the myths and urban legends, debunking some claims about displacement in cities? What's going on in cities?
Yes, actually, urban internal displacement is one of our new, and well, it's not new, actually. We've been working on it for quite some time, but it's one of our now priority, I would say, research streams at IDMC, because we have we know with the rate of urbanization across the world that the majority of internal displacement and displacement generally, even cross-border movements, you know, refugees when they leave their countries tend to flock to cities, you know, where it's easier, you know, to have access to services, etc. And it's certainly the case for IDPs. We're looking at broadly, you know, a sort of rural to urban movement. But having said that, we haven't actually managed to yet quantify the exact scope of internal displacement in cities. So that's one of the first questions that we want to try and answer, is how many IDPs are there right now in cities versus in, you know, rural areas? It's much harder to count people in a city than it is to count them in a camp. And yet we know that there are fewer and fewer camp settings when it comes to IDPs. A lot of IDPs, you know, are either moving into host communities and host families, or they're moving into cities. But this is where it's when they move into a city that they become invisible. And we suspect, in some cases, can also become extremely vulnerable. So we need to better understand, first of all, the scale of the urban dimension of internal displacement. But then we need to also better understand what actually happens in a city once someone becomes displaced to it. You know, what actually happens to the city when it has to absorb large, you know, inflows of people? But how can then other dynamics in the city either create more displacement? If you look at some cities that are also prone to, that are prone to disaster risk, for example, where living in a city can actually make you more vulnerable to some of these disasters and can lead you to become displaced again, or a second or a third time. So how can cities themselves either be driving new displacement and more displacement in the future, or on the other hand, how can cities actually be conducive areas for people to find solutions and to end their condition, or, you know, the all the negative impacts that have been, you know, that are associated to their displacement? I mean, in some cases, actually, you know, it can be a positive step moving to a city, because as an IDP, you know, you will have access to more job opportunities. You may actually have have access to an income, certainly more services than you would do in an urban, in a rural area. So there are two sides of the coin, and we're trying to understand a little bit how that plays out in different contexts. Of course, it's going to vary from country to country. There are certain countries where, you know, cities are highly risky areas, you know, higher levels of criminal violence, higher, like I said, higher levels of disaster risk, and in other cases where the city can actually be can be a positive location. So, urbanization is certainly one of the key global, not challenges, but global issues that we're looking at as having a direct impact, whether it's positive or negative, on internal displacement and vice versa.
And I did a show with the head of Habitat for Humanity in Bangladesh, and it was another one of those where I just, you know, I sat here and listened, and it's beyond my imagination to try to understand what it is like to live in Bangladesh in some of the areas. I mean, I think I know, and then I hear someone that lives the life every day about disease and sanitation and food, just access to food in cities. I mean, it's something that we all need to keep front and center, if you ask me. And I have to ask a quick question, and it's not a yes or no question, but just your opinion quickly. I believe that the impact of climate change hits women and children hardest, hits them first. What are your thoughts on that? Are women and children being impacted more severely?
It's really hard to tell. I mean, we don't have any hard evidence that would allow me to answer that question in one way or another.
Okay.
I think it really varies strongly from country to country, from context to context. I'm sure that in a number of contexts, you know, women and children are the ones who are, you know, the primary victims, you know, of some of these changes. Maybe in some contexts they are the ones who move or who are the most vulnerable to all the violence, you know, that can come with that forced movement. But it's very hard to you know, to draw sort of definitive trends, I would say, on that, particularly when it comes to climate change and displacement and those impacts on women and children. We actually lack the data, to be perfectly honest with you. We haven't even been able to disaggregate our global numbers in terms of you know, age and gender, and that's a huge gap in our understanding of how it impacts on communities and on human beings, and how those vulnerabilities then play out over time. I mean, besides some case studies and some anecdotal evidence here and there, we actually don't have a robust understanding of that. It may be different, you know, on a case-by-case basis, and I'm sure that if you actually look, you know, at the local level, you would find all sorts of very different stories, you know, being told. I think, you know, coming up with a global sort of an overall trend, I think is a bit difficult.
And that's a great answer, because I don't want to be responsible for perpetuating myths. You know, it's like it's definitely, mm-hmm. at my level, it's a feeling. And you're right, it is women who are more vulnerable in terms of, you know, rape and assault and exploitation for mm-hmm. work. Like in Bangladesh, 90% of the people in the factories are women. So there's another example of how that displacement is just disproportionate on women. Go ahead.
Sorry. No, so and I just wanted to say, you know, and yet in some contexts, you know, we have documented how, for instance, you know, displacement, particularly protracted displacement in some areas in sub-Saharan Africa, I think it was in the DRC, has actually served to change some of the family dynamics that we've seen in certain, you know, households, and where women have taken a much more prominent role, paradoxically, you know, they have taken on more of a male role in dealing with a household that is ultimately, you know, disintegrated as a result of displacement. So there's always a nuance to that,
right.
to that story that needs to be brought into the
another
picture.
Spin. It's so true. So we have to wrap up, and I am just going to sincerely say thank you so much. This was wonderful for me. I hope that your story is told around the country, around the world, more and more. Thank you for the work you're doing with your organization. Our show on Tuesday is with our local show is Kim Foer and Dr. Larry Lincoln, and we're going to be talking about hospice care, a hard conversation. And our May 22nd show is Diana Liverman and Climate for Women's Voices in Climate Science, the Good, the Bad, and the Truth. Again, women's voices being underrepresented in the climate conversation. So thank you again for being a part of our show. And I appreciate again all the work you do. And everybody out there, make it a great, green, intentionally lived week. Thanks for being a part of our world.